Hello and welcome to Counterpressed on The Ringer and Spotify. I'm in the studio with Jesse Bug Humphreys and Becky Taylor Gill. I always have to go slow syllables when Becky's in as well, because otherwise it's like too many double barrels.
Jesse Bug Humphreys, Becky Taylor Gill. Yeah.
Jesse Bug Humphreys.
You have to go blah, blah, blah.
Gill.
Buh, 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 buh.
Yeah, also we're important, so you need to emphasise.
Yeah, it's true. We're doing a culture episode today, guys, which some of our best work. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, for sure.
Cultural. Yeah.
Culture.
At least mine.
And I think some of our listeners' favourite episodes, lest we forget, Wagatha Christie with Wrighty was an all-timer.
That might be the most iconic episode we've ever done.
David Beckham one was pretty good as well. We've done some good doc and movie ones. And today,
Reimagining the Conti Cup, I think, was my favourite.
Reimagining the Conti Cup was a very good one. Culture, maybe.
Guys, we're just patting ourselves on the back, being like, oh, we're so funny and interesting.
Well, I think, as you know, listener, if you haven't yet had the pleasure of listening to those ones, go back and listen, because they can be...
Because we are very funny.
We're very funny, and they can be enjoyed all times of year. Christmas, Easter, Valentine's, what else have we got going on? Summertime.
St. Patrick's Day.
St. Patrick's Day. All the classics. So yeah, do go back. Today is an interesting one, because this documentary, Copper 71, first came on my radar about September or October last year. It appeared at the BFI London Film Festival, and annoyingly, I just heard of it after they'd done the screening, and I was like, damn, that would have been so good to do as a culture episode for us. But luckily, the main release is happening right now as it comes out on the 5th of March. So there's time to go and see it, and there's time for us to talk about it.
Is it in cinemas?
I'm not sure how big the release is going to be.
Well, like,
I think the idea is that it will get released and will get bought and get some kind of screening. I would say probably a good chance of going somewhere like the BFI or a local independent and getting a chance to watch it. But yes, not sure on the specifics of the release yet. But I think the idea is that hopefully you'll get picked up. So, should we crack on and talk about Copper 71?
Let's
do it.
Let's do it. I sat down with the directors of the documentary, Rachel Ramsey and James Erskine, to talk about how they went on this amazing journey to discover all of the archive footage. The first thing I wanted to ask was, I read a little bit about it through interviews about how the project came about, but I was wondering if you go into a little more depth on that, about how you sort of discovered the story and then how you really dug into collecting all the footage and developing it into what we saw in the documentary.
So, I mean, the idea came about through our producer, Victoria, who we both worked with for a long time, and she overheard one of the women from the England team in 1971 talking on the radio. It was like 2020, I think, 2019, when she heard this. And so she said, what do you know about this story? And we, Rachel and I, had done a lot of work in football and even women's football films in the past and hadn't heard of the story. And we were like, did it really exist? Did it happen? We need to see some evidence of this. So that's where we began digging and seeing if this apparently apocryphal story of the Azteca Stadium overflowing with hundreds of thousands of people in 1971 to see a women's football match was true.
Yeah, I mean, the most wonderful thing was starting to contact the women themselves. And a lot of them had kept memorabilia, had kept newspaper clippings, some of the merchandise that had the Shotil, the mascot, on. And that really was, you know, that hard evidence that they had in their attics mainly, or had been put away in a drawer for 50 years, was really the only evidence that we started with that this thing had happened, other than the stories that they had. And we'd seen a little clip that we'd found online, which was about sort of, I think, maybe sort of 70 seconds or so of a bit of one of the matches. And in that clip, you can see that there are cameras everywhere. And we knew that it had been broadcast live. We knew that they used a lot of the same setup they used in the 1970 Men's World Cup. And so, you know, we sort of reasoned that, and slightly hoped, blind hoped maybe, that yes, the footage did exist. We knew it had been filmed. And the question was then, how on earth do you find something that nobody knows where it is, if it still exists? And we were, you know, somewhere in the vaults of TV stations in Mexico City. And one of the first things we were told when we started looking for it, that was that all of the TV archive from the main broadcasters had been destroyed in an earthquake So that started. Then we had about fires and we had about all sorts of other things. And eventually you start pulling a thread and then keep pulling it and pulling it and pulling it and start digging out, you know, the footage that we found in the end. And also we managed to get from private sources as well. So people that have been there filming in the stands. Yeah, it was absolutely incredible.
Yeah, I think for me, certainly watching it and knowing of the tournament and a bit about it, but having never seen any footage, the footage is what really kind of just obviously transforms it. But having, I guess, heard the idea in 2020 and the film coming out now, it's not actually that long in terms of gathering all that footage. So how did you manage on that ridiculous trail and adventure putting it together? How did you actually manage to collect so much in that time?
Well, we had an amazing team of people working on it. We had archive producers all around the world. We had some, you know, really brilliant team here in the UK, in London as well. And we were relying on word of mouth and all sorts putting it out. I mean, the very first trip was, I went to Mexico City early 2021 to go and see the Mexican team and to meet them. And also just to present yourselves and present the film and the idea that we were trying to make this. Because the women had been pretty traumatized from not having spoken about it for 50 years. And to we needed them all on side, of course. And we wanted their blessing to be telling their story. And yeah, it was a huge team effort. I mean, you can see on the, you know, on the end of the film, the credit roller is very long and in lots of different countries. So yeah, bringing them all together was a big team effort.
And that initial find as well in England, I think obviously the FA have tried to celebrate some of those players through the years, but how did you go about finding them? Was it like a search on Facebook, or how did you connect them and also build that trust to say, you know, we really want to tell it through your voice as well?
Well, that's how we'd heard about the story initially, was that they were, the England team were on, there was a radio interview because they had been brought together by a BBC journalist who had started to find each other through a very long and complex story. And then that got picked up by the BBC. That then got picked up by The One Show. And from there, we started to, that's how we'd heard about that story initially, and then realized that it was bigger and it was an international story at the same time. That early stage, we were also working with Professor Jean Williams, who, I mean, there's lots of people that have been doing research about this in specific countries. Just no one had brought it all together in one place yet. So Jean helped us find the women in England, introduced us, and slowly but surely, and it did take a long time, you know, before we actually went into production, we were, you know, doing development for about a year. Yeah, slowly and surely trying to win each of them over individually and speak to them all individually, which involved quite a lot of trips to various parts of the country and also to the other teams in Europe and in South America.
And at what point as well did you manage to get Serena Williams and Alex Morgan involved? And obviously they do play a role in the film, Serena Williams with that voiceover at the beginning and Alex Morgan in that interview. Did you always want to try and use them in the film once they came on board? Or was it actually, did they actually say, oh, we want to also have a role in this somehow?
No, I mean, I think we always wanted them to be part of the film. You know, we didn't just want it to be a badge stuck on there. And actually, when we first reached out to Serena and Venus, and when we first reached out to Alex and her team, they too were like, can we be part of this? You know, we want to be part of the team making this, you know, otherwise it's just, it has no weight for us either. You know, this is an area of activism in which they were all involved, and seeing great stories about women's sport and women pioneers is important to them. So we also really wanted it to have that connection, you know, that connection to more contemporary players. So it felt like, you know, the resonance of the story could be seen through the actions of today's players, but also in the wider sporting world, that it mattered, that it amplified, and that, you know, a triumph, just as in women's tennis, you know, there's been many triumphs that have helped carry other sports along, so that this moment could be seen as being a triumph that helps women, girls, people, in fact, play any sport that they want to in any guise they can.
Yeah, we wanted to speak to the players who, you know, we know were very recognisable for passing on the baton or in growing the sport. So that's when you started opening with Brandi Chastain, and then moving on to Alex Morgan, and then in the clips at the end, moving on to the, you know, players who are playing right now from all sorts of countries. But yeah, it's putting the 1971 team and all the women who played in that tournament into their, you know, their solid place in history, which is just as relevant as the other much more recognisable faces that we see in other parts of the film.
Were you surprised that Brandi Chastain didn't know about it? And did that reaction really hammer home, oh, we have to start the film from this point because of that reveal?
Nobody had heard about it, genuinely. I mean, there's this small handful of people right now who were talking about it. One, and you know, I mentioned Jean earlier, who's a professor of you know, of women's history. She had featured it, and there was, as you know, James and I were saying, we've made quite a few football films about football ourselves, and researched heavily into that world, and we'd not heard about it, and it's still the same reaction you get now. I mean, even watching the footage again, I mean, we've seen it obviously so many times, and all the clips, but it still gives me goosebumps, because you still realize you've lived your whole life believing that this wasn't possible, and then you see it happen right in front of you.
And is this given you guys more of a sort of motivation as well to dig deeper into some of those even forgotten stories that still haven't been told in women's football, because there are so many of them? And like you said, with the archiving around the footage in Mexico that was disappeared in an earthquake or a fire or whatever, there is so much that hasn't been archived and that people are still attempting to put together and piece together these stories. So are you guys looking at trying to discover those other stories as well?
Well, I think we hope that, you know, this is the start of a, you know, a whole new genre of sports films and films in general, is that there's so many. We could only make one film. We had one, you know, one 90-minute film that we want to make about this one tournament. And we absolutely didn't want to make it about the history of football, the history of women's football, or the forgotten whole history. I mean, there's, as you say, there's so many stories over 100 years of, and that's just women's football. I mean, you know, if you're looking at sports, women's contributions to that in so many other places. And I think, you know, if we've always said this before, you know, if anyone wants to go make a more in-depth story about any one of the players or about one of the specific teams from this tournament, there's so many different versions of these stories that can be done, you know. And we say there's whole books and films told about single men's matches, and this was a whole, you know, the whole tournament that was forgotten. So yes, hopefully. And I think we'd encourage anyone to, if we can find something this big, and we did find the footage, yeah, what else is out there?
Right, first things first, Copper 71, directed by James Erskine and Rachel Ramsey. Did we enjoy it? Yay or nay?
Yay.
Oh, wow, in unison. And I'm going to go yay as well. Yeah, I did really enjoy it. I went into it knowing straight away what it's about. It's about the 1971.
Unlike Brandi Chastain.
Unlike Brandi Chastain, which we'll come on to. But yes, so Copper 71 is named after the 1971 unofficial Women's World Cup, which some people may know about, others may not. I think as women's football has become bigger, its histories, its unknown and known histories have been talked about a lot more. This tournament first kind of came to my attention in 2019, which the director, Rachel Ramsey, talks about similar time. She heard a documentary, or she heard one of the England players talking on the radio about her experiences playing in this tournament. So that's when it first came up on my radar, because I think in 2019, there was a lot of historical uncovering. I think there was a lot of conversation about the ban on women's football in England during the 2017 Euros when Channel 4 showed it. But that sort of continued on. And I think people were still finding out about it for the first time. I feel like we've reached the point now where everyone kind of knows about it, but the 1971 World Cup hasn't maybe quite hit that mainstream notoriety yet. Did you guys know of it?
Yes, I knew about it. I mean, there's obviously like loads of footage that you've never seen before, and there's lots of stories in there that I didn't know. I think I knew like a very basic level of knowledge about it.
Yeah, I knew about it. I think mainly as well because I did, gonna plug myself here, for the World Cup, and just before, I watched every World Cup final and wrote about it on Flying Geese. I was trying to figure out, like, was there enough stuff available to, like, do something on that? And there just wasn't sort of freely available, which is why the film's so cool, because you can see so much of the actual tournament.
Yeah, same for me as well. Just like you were saying, Becky, is like, I knew of it, but I'd never seen any video footage. Mm. I'd seen pictures online and other documentaries. I'd heard people talk about it. I'd seen the players be talked about and be interviewed in relation to England teams, you know, recently. But I had never seen footage of the tournament. Shall we get on to the quality of football in that tournament?
Let's just get out of the way early.
Shall we get out of the way, guys?
Yeah. Yeah, it was bad. But I also will say, is lots of football from that time as bad as well? Yeah. I think that's what's funny about it is it's like, oh my God, some of it is awful. But really, if you watch some of the men's World Cups from similar times, you're like, yeah, this is awful too.
It's very much of its time because in that time, and it happened in this tournament and it happened in the 1970 Mexico World Cup, which plays a big part in this tournament happening. Basically, if you had one technically gifted player, they could dribble through everyone and score, aka Pele, or some of the Mexican women or Argentinian women that play in this tournament. But apart from that, it's a lot of like real stodgy, bish real bash. Bad. The pitch is terrible.
Some of my favourite moments throughout watching this documentary is sitting next to Jesse, who's going like, pass it. Fuck's sake, like when they make a mistake.
It was so
like,
annoying.
Getting like so like, it, like this happened like 60 years ago, Jesse. Like,
it's just irritating when you see it and you're just like, oh my God, just pass the ball. Or like when you see the goalkeeper like running out of the penalty area, you're like, obviously you should not be doing that if you're the goalkeeper.
Oh my God, the goalkeeping was really bad. Also, it's at a time when goalkeepers didn't wear gloves either, and they were just doing it with their hands.
Gloves and someone, the England goalie had gloves on, I noticed, but I did notice that other goalkeepers didn't.
Yeah, weird. And it's like a really heavy ball as well. You're like, oh God.
I did say to Jesse in the pub afterwards, I could play in the 1971 World Cup.
I think we could all play. Yeah. A counter-pressed team would have done well in that tournament.
Wow, imagine if we could time travel and we could do a counter-pressed episode where we all went back to play in the 1971 World Cup.
So let's talk about the film itself, because that is a little bit the context. So the film opens with something that made me cringe deep inside my soul, because even though it probably is well true that Brandi Chastain didn't know about this 1971 tournament, it was extremely hammy the way that they presented it to her. So it starts with a Serena Williams opening monologue, which was great stuff. Who doesn't love a bit of Serena? Contextualise as well, Serena and Venus are exec producers on the project, as is Alex Morgan. So it starts with this really quite cool, you know, deeply dramatic and amazing Serena Williams monologue. And then you're like, oh, okay, Brandi Chastain's here. And then it's like, Brandi, do you want to watch this? And they hand her an iPad and she's like, okay. And then she's like, is this men's football? What am I watching? And you're like, oh, do me a favour.
If she didn't know about the 1971 Women's World Cup, what does she think she's being interviewed for?
I did think like the whole setup. The whole setup was a little bit annoying. Do you think it was legit or do you think it was faked?
It felt faked.
It felt fake.
Yeah, I agree. Again, what did she think she was being interviewed for?
Like, yeah, it felt forced.
And then obviously there's like interviews much later from her throughout and at the end, and you're like, well, you obviously do know about it.
Yeah.
Because you're talking about it.
Yeah.
I think they could have just stuck with the Serena monologue.
Yeah, that felt forced, like it didn't need to be there.
Also because we all know about it because we've gone to see the film about it. So it's like, okay, everyone knows what we're seeing. I was like, and I don't think it's really lost on anyone that like this is sort of a forgotten bit of history as well. Like I didn't need to be like, I don't know, convinced that no one knew about it.
I need to have my hand held through that whole setup. Exactly. Because you're right, we've spoken a lot on these culture episodes when we've watched stuff about people talking to audiences that don't know football like they're idiots. Under Pressure, the USA Netflix one especially, but in Beckham's one, there was a lot of that as well. But I think that's a very celebrity audience.
In general, I thought that it did that a lot better. Mm. Obviously, that beginning part is just a bit like, I don't know, I think it's just a weird choice. But I think throughout the film, I was like, okay, I think they're doing this well for like an audience that potentially doesn't know anything about women's football and also an audience that is obviously very well clued up. I was so close to rolling my eyes when they started talking about dick hair ladies. But then I was like, okay, you've spent like
2 seconds,
a reasonable amount of time on this where like people who didn't know now know and have some context.
Yeah.
And people like me who are very, very aware of it don't have to sit through this long like, they were banned and then all
totally
this.
Totally agree. I think it's a hard balance to strike as well, to win over people like us who are coming into it with a lot of knowledge and will eye roll because you're telling them obvious things, and other people in the audience who are going to see this and be intrigued but not know. And that is really hard to get
right. I think like all the documentaries we've watched, Beckham, USA have both done that really badly. Mm-hmm. And I think it is something that's really, really difficult, especially for those like very, very wide audiences. And I think maybe they know that the audience that are going to come see this are probably more aware of women's football, because you already have to know that it's a documentary that's being made about this thing that not that many people know about outside of a women's football landscape, you know? So I think they've done that well, apart from that first weird Brandi Chastain bit.
Yeah, and it was jarring straight away, because I was like, I might have to leave. It's going to be 90 minutes of this.
What are you doing here, Brandi?
Yeah, it felt forced. And I think it also felt like we've got this big interview, so we have to use it.
Mm.
And it felt like that at the end when Alex Morgan appears. And what frustrated me so much.
I lost my head at that bit.
Well, we all did a little bit, because we were tutting.
I was rattled.
We were tutting and
hissing. My noggin
was
boiled.
My noggin was so boiled.
For me, and I know you guys are going to have something to say on it that might be a bit different, but for me, what frustrated me so much about having Alex Morgan at the end of this is that she's an exec producer on this, so I can understand you want to hear from her because you've got that access. People will know, as I've said before on this show, I've done a full 360 on Alex Morgan from 2019. Mm. I stan her so hard. She is an icon, she's a legend, she is the moment. But the content they got from her and the content they decided to use was so boring and so random and thrown in for the sake of it, being like, yeah, the World Cup's awesome now and we got great leagues. I'm like, you surely could have asked her better stuff, got better stuff. Like, if you're going to use her in a better way. And that's what frustrated me, because it also, again, felt random to end on that, where they started with Brandi Chastain and they ended on Alex Morgan and Brandi Chastain again.
Well, the problem is, spoiler alert, the USA are not part of this World Cup. And I think the thing that was really weird and frustrating, and I guess maybe this is because, like, it's American made or whatever, it's like you watch this whole amazing tournament and you're like really all in on it. It's like really quite emotional. And then suddenly we're like, and now America are amazing at football. I'm like, that's not really the point. It's like nothing to do. Like, it would be interesting, like, if you're going from like an American audience, like, why wasn't America there? Like, when did the USA like start getting involved? You know, like, I know they went and did some of the like FIFA test tournaments before the original World Cup. Like, I'm happy to hear that history. I understand that this is an American-made
documentary. Sorry, the way you say I'm happy is like you're commissioning it. I'm okay with that. If you're putting Americans in, I'm okay with that. But I'm not okay with this.
I just thought it was like, it was just a bit strange when basically you have the story of like the teams who participated in it, and then suddenly we have to watch all these clips of America winning World Cups. Great, we know they've won loads of World Cups. Then suddenly you get like a weird montage of like England doing some stuff as well, and I was just like,
as random clips they could get a hold of, basically.
Yeah, and I just thought it was a shame, because like for the countries who were involved, there's like really interesting different through lines to their success or lack of now. And instead it was like, now look at America because they're really good. And I'm like, but that's not actually the point. It's almost more interesting to be like, okay, but like, look at teams like Mexico or Argentina, who had like, you watch them playing and they're clearly like the most talented teams there, but they're not the best teams in global football now. Mm. But then teams like England, for example, have really achieved on a global stage, but only in the past sort of 10 years or so. Like, I thought the way they wrapped it up was so strange.
I thought that it was just such a shame to not talk to any current players of Argentina, Mexico, England, Denmark, Italy, France,
I was
like all of those clubs that are involved.
Leaving, I was like, why did they not go and get Pernilla Harder? She is like such a good speaker on this kind of stuff. She's so interesting. And Denmark had such an amazing tournament. And the Danish women's team have had to also fight for so much in recent years. Mm. It's like really fascinating parallels. I was like, it was screaming out for something like that.
Yeah, I'd be intrigued to know if, you know, approaches were made that maybe didn't happen. I don't know. But it is sometimes hard to like secure those interviews. But I agree. It felt like if you're going to have one big name current player who happens to be exec producer, maybe let's get a bit of a European voice or something different to reflect on that. Talk about the overall style, though. I really enjoyed the way that they put it into this kind of like wider cultural, music, fashion sort of little whip round 60s, 70s, kind of taking you through a bit of the context of society at the time, but also the women themselves and how they're involved. Like, the edit felt really fun. And I think that was important, because I think there were some big conversations at play around, you know, why women's football didn't grow, or, you know, the people that are very opposed to this happening. And that's mentioned by David Goldblatt, who appears in it as a historian several times, talking about the wider context. But what I liked a lot is like it was a celebration of these women like having loads of fun and becoming celebrities for a summer. And I really enjoyed the sort of juxtaposition of pictures of them, which had been recolored for this, and the footage, which looked so vibrant and amazing. And then like Carol, Tracy, my fave hun, like just popping up, and the woman, the goalkeeper from Mexico was amazing. Like just popping up and sort of giving their reflections now. I really like the jump between the two, and it made it go really quick. Like it didn't drag for me at all. I just really, really loved the jump through the tournament.
I think they did that so well with like, because that's what people care about, right? Is the personal stories that are behind. Because obviously the football's terrible. Like bless them, the football's awful. And it's really interesting to see those matches and watch that footage as well. But I think they did really well at talking about those personal stories, and it was really emotional. Like as they're recalling these like this incredible tournament and how they were treated is really, really special. And it was really, really nice to hear from those players that were involved. I think without them it wouldn't have worked as a documentary at all.
They're also all just such great vibes.
Oh my god, they were so
hilarious. I wanted to hang out with all of them. They were all so funny. But I need to especially shout out the Italians.
Yeah, the Italians were good.
They stole the show. They were so, so funny. Both at the time and reflecting back now, I was like, I am obsessed with you guys.
I also loved the two Danish women. Yeah. My favourite quote, I laughed out loud, one of them saying, I can knit and I can use a chainsaw. Like, oh my God, I can knit.
Yeah, there was, I mean, similarly to the fact that we all sort of know of the tournament but don't know the real details is, I didn't really know what went down, and I think it was quite funny, and this is such a kind of like English arrogance factor is like England were really bad in that tournament, and like they were so arrogant coming in, and they said that like we were really naive and we were so convinced we were like going to win the whole thing, and then we got there and we just got played off the park. And I think that is really missed when histories aren't recorded in certain ways. Like you don't get that real authentic element, like when people talk about official men's World Cups in previous years, or when we talk about the modern Women's World Cup, is like we have that footage, we have that knowledge, but the assumptions that are made about what happened in this tournament are huge because no one saw it happen apart from over 100,000 people in Mexico who had a whale of a time.
They were loving it.
Also want to shout out the iconic logo for the tournament. I will be getting her tattooed. And the story behind how that the word is a flower in Mexico. It stands for a flower, but also a warrior, Shakti?
Yeah, something like that.
So it's a flower, but also, like, if you go back further, yeah, it has warrior connotations. The vibes are so vibey.
Yeah, their outfits, we just simply do not do it like that anymore. I want to see England women arriving at the Euros next year in denim cowboy hats.
Yeah.
Like, that's what I need. I couldn't work out which team that was from the picture when it was coming through.
There was a lot of matching. Everyone sort of had matching outfits.
As they should. Yeah. And they were like, it was like a denim suit and also a denim cowboy hat. Bring that back.
The looks were great. Yeah. The looks were great.
And I think maybe that's just of the time as well. Like,
yeah,
some of the outfits, so just the picture. Pictures.
The hair. The hair was really good.
Oh my God, the hair.
So amazing, sort of like a mod, like, you know, short fringe at the front and then long at the back.
Yeah, I loved her. She was, I think she was one of the ones being interviewed with the short hair.
Yeah.
I need to sit down with her specifically and be like, tell me all of the lesbian drama that went on at this World Cup.
Becky leaned over to me halfway through this screening and went, how many of them do you think were shagging each other?
And then a bit later on, when it was like, there was a comment from one of them being like, you know, we were really tight knit, we really like, we all loved each other, and me and Jesse looked over each other like,
these are the accusations people throw at us for not being a serious podcast. Come on, focus on the terrible football and not the storylines. No, I'm joking, but yes, the vibes are high. And come on, it's bloody Martini and Rosso sponsoring it, their second sponsorship of a women's football tournament. Why are these Italian alcohol legends the godfathers of women's football? Honestly, we thought it was Arnold Clark, but truly
no, they were the OGs.
It's really interesting as well, actually, looking back at this era. And you sort of touched on it, the way that Mexico and Argentina have kind of like fallen behind in modern context. But this tournament and the tournament in Italy the year before in 1970, they were organised by an Italian football federation. Like, Italian women's football was the place to be. They were leading the way. And it's not exactly like they've died. Like, the national team's doing okay. They obviously had quite crap World Cup and Euros. But the domestic league is going from strength to strength. But it is interesting how, like, they were way ahead of the curve of saying, like, we've got a federation and we're going to be organising tournaments and we want you guys to play. And Martino Rosso and a few promoters in Mexico were like, OK, let's do it. There's pushback and they end up putting it in even bigger stadiums and they fill them out. I was like, oh, my God, a moment.
I mean, really, if we're honest, it should have been an Italy-Denmark final, which I think would have been really interesting football-wise.
That's true. Italy were robbed.
Oh, yeah. God, it's funny.
I was mad about that boiled my noggin. And that was still also 50 years ago.
So in the semi-final, there is a situation with a indirect free kick that is taken.
I think there's stuff before that.
Yeah, well, there were some slightly spicy challenges and spicy calls.
There was already a goal that
basically Italy had two goals disallowed for like incredibly spurious reasons in their match against Mexico. And the Italian ladies suggest, what they say, like, oh, I think we can like finally say it now.
Yeah.
That the referee wanted Mexico. Everyone wanted Mexico to be the final.
There was a conspiracy.
Maybe my favourite part of the whole doc was the semi-final between Italy and Mexico and the going back and forth between. So the free kick is an absolute amazing goal. Like, the only good goal that we saw in the whole tournament from their, like, star player that was ruled out because apparently the referee had said it was an indirect free kick, which in what world would that have need to be an indirect free kick? And the Italians are talking about it and, yeah, they're saying, you know, we can say it now. And then it goes over to the Mexican women who are like, no, like, dead serious, like, absolute deadpan. They're not even, like, you know, a little twinkle in their eye knowing that they've got away with it. They're like, no, he put his hand up for an indirect free kick. He had two fingers up. Yeah. So, like, it's legit.
They're hearing none of it.
Like, they are so convinced.
But what goes down after is one of my favourite bits of the whole movie because, and another thing that's been lost to the history books, and we are constantly trying to make sure that people know that shithousing and a little bit of, you know, fisticuffs or whatever is maybe required sometimes in games is okay. And we need to move away from this, like, beautiful girly image that surrounds
more
women's football.
Fights, more
in
fights.
In 1971, they were scrapping on the pitch.
So good.
It was amazing.
And we need to make sure people know about that history.
Some of those images are so funny. Like, they're, like, literally being, like, dragged away from each other. There's,
these,
like,
women
so
walked
many,
so how a Sissoko could run, is
they
all
are
I'm
literally
saying.
Shoving each other's heads in the dirt, pulling each other's hair, punching each other. It was amazing. And we don't want to see full-on brawls like that on the pitch.
I do.
But sometimes, if the moment takes you and you get frustrated, like, we need to stop this whole conversation about, like, oh, we shouldn't see that in a women's game. I'm sorry, in 1971 they were doing it and we can still have it now. The four mothers of everything.
Honestly. And those Italian players, it was so funny to me. Like, I don't know who got punched first, but someone got punched and then it was
just
like,
went in.
And the coaches were trying to separate them. And anyway, what happens is Mexico win.
The game is stopped 10 minutes early.
Yeah, they can't even finish the game. Mexico win. Italy was robbed. And it ends up being a Mexico-Denmark final. But the game is nearly not played because of this sort of protest / non-protest that happens when the Mexican players, there's a sort of build-up where there's a conversation around not getting paid. So all these women were participating as amateurs.
Guys, do you not think that time is a flat circle?
I know.
Watching this, I was like, you could make this documentary and the themes it touched on around this stuff in, like,
any era. Now.
Every
you can make
decade.
It now.
Yeah.
And I think that's maybe was what's so frustrating about the end as well, as it being, like, so American-focused, is I thought it was very much like, oh, look, we're all good now. Like, it's so happy and, like, women's football is the fastest growing sport in the world. And I thought that it was a real shame to not point out that, like, these things are still happening. Mm. Like, decades later, all of the things that happen in this documentary are still happening. And it's just, it was frustrating. And I think maybe that's what was wrong with the ending is not touching on those themes that like run through women's football forever.
Yeah, it would have been cool to have a sort of nod to, I mean, it was made before the latest Women's World Cup, but it would be nice to have a sort of a modern nod, like, oh, and obviously nothing's changed because they were doing a sort of protest for 2 million pesos that they wanted. But some of their goalkeeper says in the documentary, like, it wasn't actually about that, but it sort of got misconstrued. But they started getting phone calls and threats about how dare they not play the final, they should play because of national pride. And I think it is that sort of unfair burden that's placed a lot on women and women athletes, where like they should be willing just to do it for the pride, they should be noble and just get on with it. And I think we do sometimes see it in the men's game and other tournaments where there are also money issues. It's not something that's exclusive to women's football, but I think we see it a lot more where it's like, oh, well, you know, it's just the women doing it. So, like, you know, it's not being taken as seriously or it's not as professionalized and that's just the way it is. And, like, you should do it out of respect for your country. It's like, no, like, these people are, they're not professionals, but they are athletes and they're doing it. And this has been organized.
And they're bringing in so much money.
Yes.
And that is the frustrating thing, is like, it's one of those difficult things to grapple with, really, because it's such an amazing thing that happened. But it happened because men were like, we can make money from this. Mm. And so it's frustrating in many ways that they didn't get paid. That wasn't even really a conversation about them getting paid until the very end, when they were like, hold on a second. But also that, yeah, this, like, some parts of me were like, when I'm watching this, I'm like, I want to burn down women's football and start it again without FIFA, without the football associations of these countries. But then also it's like, but that money is coming from men who are capitalizing on it and not. Oh, it's just, but again, time is a flat circle and I'm just very frustrated.
I think what's interesting about that kind, and I understand that thing, but I think also what's really interesting to take from this is FIFA and the national federations were so resistant to this and there was so much pressure put on it. And as time goes on, what happens is FIFA obviously do change their minds, in inverted commas, of this, but they decide to basically start to take control of women's football. Mm. And then I think what's interesting is the narrative that comes after that is like that no one's interested in women's football and it won't make money. That's like the real narrative that exists sort of like commercially over football until very, very recently. And I thought that was kind of fascinating because I know it's frustrating that obviously it's just men using it to make money, but the fact that there were business people who were like, if we make an effort and we advertise it loads and we sell loads of tickets, it will make money. And then you move into this world where everyone's being told, no, it won't. And it's like, but why are the people who are running this sport, why are they the ones who seemingly think it won't make money? And it just kind of makes you realise like how much of it, even by like the federations, even today, it's all about like control. So it doesn't take away from the men's game.
Yeah, and after the 1970 tournament, which it was similarly like an exhibition one in Italy, FIFA sort of panicked and they basically sent a survey to all the national associations saying, what are you doing about women's football? Are you doing anything? Are you making sure you control it? And only a handful of associations were even bothering to get involved. But it was almost like a moral panic rather than a sort of strategic thing about how can we grow the women's game. It was like, got to get a hold of this crisis, guys. And I think that just shows everything about, like, it's always been about how to control rather than to actually like succeed and grow, because the proof was there already, like an exhibition Euros, back-to-back World Cups with only 6 teams, that brands were interested. Yes, there's a narrative around men will want to watch women in their shorts and et cetera, but
I just looked at Jesse and they knew exactly what I was going to say. There was like a man on the radio, a Mexican guy, the quote, and it's like, you know, football and women, like it's the things that men love. And Jesse was like, I get behind that.
I was like, I'm into that. Look, I am who I am. And they're like, we like football and we like women. I can't deny that that is true for myself as well.
The branding was accurate. That's all we could say. So yes, there is this sort of protest. The Mexican players end up conceding and going ahead with the game. It is interesting to think what would have happened, but then would have anything happened? Because we still don't know much about the tournament anyway. Would they have got paid?
Maybe they'd have put Italy in the final like they deserved.
Probably.
I'd love to have known. I mean, the football is so bad, but also I think Italy and Denmark were the best of the bad. I think that would have been interesting.
And so then we get on to the final. Denmark facing Mexico. Denmark wiped the floor with them, really. The size difference is picked up on.
Yeah, that is crazy how
they're so tall.
The Danish players.
The Denmark players were elite, proper athletes. Like, they really had their shit together. And so we have this big celebration with the final. And then we sort of move on to the sort of last chapter of the documentary where it's like, okay, what now? All of these teams, especially Denmark, go back to like big fanfare and big celebrations. But all of them say that completely dried up. Carol Wilson gets invited to St. James's Park and it starts with her talking about, you know, growing up in Newcastle and going to games with her dad. And she's brought up on stage at an event at the club and embarrassed and ridiculed for her participation in the tournament. And she never wants to play football again. And all of them are sort of banned from playing, or the teams disband, or everything sort of disappears. And it sort of tells you exactly why this documentary's made, or women's football's in the position it is now, where it's like that moment was such a flash in the pan, such a sort of... It's weird because we have these cycles in modern day women's football too, where 2012 Olympics was meant to be this great showcase for women's football. 2015 World Cup, when England did really well, finished third. 2019, it does feel like we've got some more proper momentum now, and it actually does translate into something tangible. But even then, everything was such a flash in the pan, and 71 was the true first ever like moment that wasn't a moment in women's football, because people paid attention for 5 minutes and then they were like, okay, back to what you were doing, back in your box. And there was no proper effort to continue what those women had started.
Like I said, time is a flat circle. It's just, I'm kind of sick of the conversations after every World Cup, like, this is it. This is, you know, there was a quote in the documentary from a newspaper that I was like, you could read that today. It was like, now girls will want to play football. And it's like, I don't know. There was part of me that was like, I'm so frustrated that it's just like, we keep having the same conversations over and over and over again until we die.
But I think the thing it showed is also like all of this stuff requires effort. Like when you're talking about like living in a deeply misogynistic society, that nothing does change overnight. And also that's because everyone who has the power to put attention on stuff has to keep things going. Like basically the forces you're going to be up against mean that grassroots movements are always going to be really hard to sustain. And I think, you know, it is really telling when we talk about why after every World Cup do we say like something's going to be really big and then nothing happens? It's like, well, you know, what about all the media organisations that will put loads of money into coverage for the World Cup and then axe that as soon as it's finished? That's your why. You know, like, what about federations who, you know, will make sure like a team sort of makes it to the World Cup and has everything they need, but as soon as like they get back home, everything's forgotten about for you? That's your why. So I think that was what was really important to remember, is like all of the successes can just disappear overnight if you're not continually pushing for more and asking for more, and the people in power will give you it as well. That's what's the sad and kind of frustrating thing, is you can shout about stuff as much as you want, but you also need the buy-in from elsewhere.
And in the lead up to the Women's Euros, there was quite a big effort to get the Lost Lionesses, as they were called, together. A lot of the England players on the documentary said they didn't talk for 50 years, which is mad, because those should be sort of the best years of your life. And we all participate in team sports for a reason. And a lot of that is about the camaraderie. It's about your teammates. It's about the friends you meet along the way.
Profound.
Yeah. And so it's really sad to see that these women were basically shamed into never talking to each other again. You know, the FA has done work recently to try and celebrate these women, give them retrospective caps and things like that. But a lot of that work will never make up for what happened and what they went through and how they were treated back in the day and essentially laughed at. But they're all icons now and we love them.
Yeah, I think it's really nice to get their stories in a way that makes them feel proud of it, in a way that it can be celebrated. Because yeah, the way that I you said before, Flo, about how the teams came back to like fanfare, but actually England were the ones that said actually there was no one at the airport when we got back. There wasn't one person with a camera. And it's just, yeah, being able to celebrate them in a way that helps them realize that it was extremely iconic what they did, and we love them. They were founders in England women's football history.
We stan.
I will say it's interesting because I did speak to someone, and I don't know how much maybe this plays a role, but I spoke to someone who made it also sound like there was some kind of tension around the first official England players and that group of Lost Lionesses, because I think there was also a feeling that, like, because the team going there was basically the initiative of the manager. That
it wasn't like the unofficial national team.
They've got a sort of like complex legacy, I think, among some of the other women who also played slightly after, which I find quite interesting in terms of being like, yes, they went and played for England, but also it wasn't like they were selected by England. And I think, again, that's one of those things where it feels really sad because you want to, like, you want to celebrate these women, but I can also understand how it must feel if you were then selected to feel like these people have a, you know, a different kind of legacy. And really, I think there's space for both legacies. And I feel like that frustration maybe actually just speaks to the fact, like, how little attention both groups of women are given. I think that's, like, it's quite interesting and, yeah, quite sad in some ways, the way that it feels like, oh, everyone sort of feels a bit forgotten.
And then we have the finale, the end, after all of the kind of sad bit, which is the... it's made loads of progress, isn't it so great now? And Brandi Chastain reappearing to talk about 91, 99, etc. And Alex Morgan. I read a good review, actually, by Stephen Sato in Variety, who I think summed up that last bit perfectly when he said, adding more promotional value than purpose, which I think is the best way to sum it up. Is it the best way to end it? I think maybe the theme-wise, yes. On what you want to say, yes. The right people and the right words, no.
I don't really agree on the theme either. I think that there's so many... it just felt so like, everything's good now, okay, bye. And it just felt like a lost opportunity to be like, these things are still happening.
I think what was really frustrating as well, even within the American bit, is that they had a very similar experience after the 1999 World Cup, where they thought this, you know, they sold out the Rose Bowl and there's, you know, tens of thousands of people there and they win and they have this big moment where they think it's going to be the step forward, and then actually also they're back in like tiny stadiums and no one cares. And I really recommend, even though she blocked me on Twitter during the World Cup, Caitlin Murray's book about it.
That is a good book.
Because it is really, really interesting. And I was like, yeah, that's kind of the
angle. It's called
the
National Team.
Yeah, the National Team. And it's sort of all about the history of the women's national team, but specifically focusing on like their fights with the Federation. It's probably genuinely the best women's football book I've read. But I think that would have been a really... if they wanted the American angle, I think that would have been a really interesting thing, especially because Brandi Chastain was bloody there. Like, so you could ask her about that kind of stuff. I think talking about today, what's made me realize about it is what is really interesting is what you're saying, Becky, about like kind of history repeating itself. And I think it would have been really interesting if they could have pulled out some of those echoes and like the experiences that it did happen again and again and again in terms of like big moment forgotten about.
I don't know, maybe it was a bit like, God, this keeps happening, and like how do we wrap this up without continuing this documentary forever? But I still think that it's difficult to carry on talking about it without, you know, adding like half an hour onto the doc, but there's a better way to do it, I think, than how they did it. And it kind of comes back to like, oh yes, no, we're watching something that has been funded by Americans and is exec produced by someone on the US women's national team. And like I said, like you said, I really like Alex Morgan as well. I think she's done a lot of really great stuff. It was so incredible to hear from those women. And I think like from post Brandi Chastain in the beginning to when she comes back on screen, I was like, this is amazing. This is so good. I don't know. It took away a little bit, that ending, for me.
Could have done like a cool getting some women from the tournament together to go and meet like the US women's national squad and share some stories.
I would have loved them to get together, but obviously
everyone's very spread
all
out
over the world.
But I obviously, like, the Lionesses have like had some of those players at training camps and there's been a bit of an exchange and like a reflection. So it would have been cool to kind of see some of that and like some conversations shared and that sort of reflecting back. But can't have it all, guys, but we'd all rate it pretty highly.
Yeah.
I think it's really worth seeing. Yeah. I think the history of women's football is so undertold and so under-researched, and it's such a shame because there are so many amazing stories out there, you know, even beyond sort of, I think, politics that you can take and sort of understand from it. I think even beyond that, like, what's so important is these are women who went and did something really, really amazing, and they're such interesting, fun, charismatic people. And actually, I think, you know, there's lots to be said sort of about, like, yeah, the socio-political elements of it and what we can learn from that. But I think also, like, crucially, it's just so worth sort of spending some time with those women and just, like, appreciating them and their history for what it is.
Yeah, so if you go on Dogwoof, who are the UK production company that sort of took it on, if you go on their website, you can see where it's being played from 5th of March onwards. Quite a few places, quite a few sort of like picture house or indie cinemas in London, a few outside of London as well, in Yorkshire, in the North East, and beyond. So probably best to go on there and have a look where you can see it. But yeah, would recommend.
Absolutely go and see it.
100%. Well, guys, that's another culture episode in the bag. Love to see where the next one takes us. We're just loving the films. We're loving the documentary.
Someone send us some more films.
Anyway, over and out. We will see you soon.